So today, so we're very happy that our speaker today is Manu Shan. So Manuel got his PhD from Princeton in 2017, working with David Spergel. And since then, he's been a Chamberlain Fellow at Berkeley. His interests are broadly in the area CMB and large-scale structure. And so today, he's going to tell us about halo gas thermodynamics from the CMB. Okay, and so Manu, whenever you're ready, please take it away.
Cool. Thanks a lot, Neil. Thank you for having me. Thank you for the introduction and organizing all the meetings. It's really nice to be back here, even if it's just virtually. And I'm excited to present to you two papers that came out a week ago on the archive. And so these papers are a measurement of the thermal and kinematic Sunyaev-Zel'dovich effects using ACCS data. So these were work with Stefania Amodeo, who's a postdoc at Cornell, Simone Ferraro at Berkeley Lab, Nick Battaglia at Cornell, at the ACT collaboration, and key without which this project wouldn't have been possible from Kendrick Smith and Marina Vargas Magaña. So before starting and presenting those measurements, I thought I would give you a bit of motivation for what we're trying to do and why it's helpful for large-scale structure and galaxy formation. And what we're trying to do is map the baryons around halos. And the reason it's interesting, one of the reasons is the following. If you look at hydro simulations and you compare the dark matter profiles around halos to the gas profiles, in a non-radiative simulation, you might find that those profiles are somewhat similar. But in a realistic simulation with feedback, this is feedback from galaxy formation. So we're talking about supernova explosion and energy injection in the gas from active galactic nuclei. So in those realistic simulations, what you find is that the gas profiles around halos are much more extended, much more puffed out than in the dark matter. And so in the rest of the talk, I'll be focusing on these baryons here, and I'll loosely say baryons or gas interchangeably. The reason for this is that only 5 or 10% of the baryons are not in the form of gas and basically the form of stars. So as I said, this feedback pushes the gas outside of galaxy halos. It pushes the gas outside of the virial radius of these halos. And one consequence of this is that the gas in the outskirts of low-mass halos at high redshift is far away, it's diffuse, it's cold. And because of this, it's hard to observe in emission. So in particular, it's very hard to observe in X-rays, where the X-ray emission typically scales as the square of the gas density times room temperature for Bremsstrahlung. And so this gas is hard to observe. So this has been called the missing baryon problem. And you may or may not think of these baryons are missing, they're just further out. And you may or may not think of this as a problem, you may think of it as an opportunity. Because what it says is that the gas profile around these halos has a very large response to the amplitude of those feedback. And so if you can measure the extent of those gas profiles, you can learn a lot about feedback. And the effectiveness, the amplitude of those feedback parameters is basically currently unknown. And that's one of the largest uncertainties in galaxy formation. So if you can map those missing baryons, you can learn a lot about galaxy formation, and that's one of the motivations. I should also say, please don't hesitate to interrupt at any time with questions. I may not be able to see the raised hand, so just shout and interrupt me. All right, so mapping the baryons in order to learn about galaxy formation. The other motivation is mapping the baryons to learn more about cosmology from weak lensing surveys. And the point here is fairly simple. The baryons are 15% of the total matter in the universe. And experiments like Rubin, Roman, or Euclid are going to measure the small scale power spectrum from lensing to about percent precision. If you don't know where 15% of the mass is, it's going to be hard to analyze percent precision data. If you don't know where 15% of the mass is, this is as much as a 30% uncertainty on the matter power spectrum, since the power spectrum is the square of the density. And indeed, this is what you find. This shows a number of lensing power spectrum, the relative difference between the realistic case and the dark matter-only case as a function of scale. And each curve here is a different hydro simulation with different prescriptions for the amplitude of feedback. And a lot of them are perfectly currently realistic simulations. And what you can see is that the scatter in their predictions for the Lensing power spectrum is indeed about 30%. So this is the main limiting theoretical uncertainty for weak Lensing surveys. And this is something that you could address if you know where the baryons were. So that's the second motivation. And just to clarify that this is not just about future Lensing surveys, but it's already an important question. You may have heard of this Lensing is low tension on small scales in papers led by Alex Iloto, Sean Saito, Johannes Langer. And this refers to the fact that if you look at CMAS galaxies, which are the galaxies we'll be focusing on, and I'll say more about this, when you look at the galaxy-galaxy Lensing signal from these CMAS objects as a function of radius with respect to the center, you obtain a certain measurement. These are the data points. But if you compare that to the theory prediction, the theory prediction is the dashed line. And so the theory overpredicts that signal by a large amount, as much as 30%. Now, where does this theory come from? This theory curve assumes that the baryons follow the dark matter, and it assumes a certain halo occupation distribution for those galaxies that's based on the measurement of their clustering. So basically, if you measure the clustering and you use this to predict the Lensing, you overpredict the Lensing by about 30 to 20%. Now, people have checked using simulations, hydro simulations, that the effect of the baryons could be the following: to lower the prediction by about 10 or so percent, and so alleviate part of the tension. But it would be nice to be able to put an actual curve from data as opposed to simulations, since we've seen that those simulations were very uncertain. So that's the motivation and one of the questions we'll be able to answer in these papers.
So is that tension just saying that these models don't put these galaxies in the right halos? Or is it saying that the halos have like pushed out their mass?
Right. So I don't think we know exactly what's the cause of this tension. I think there's a number of causes. And I'll show what we find for the baryons, and the baryons are part of it. But I'll give a bit of a spoiler and say that it doesn't solve this tension completely. And so there has to be something else. Mm-hmm. And so the candidates for the causes are issues with the systematics in the Lensing measurements, but also halo occupation distribution. So what you were saying about putting galaxies in the wrong halos. And in particular, one potential issue there is that those halo occupation distributions that have been fit to the clustering assume that the occupation of CMAS galaxies depend only on halo mass and not on any other property. And if this occupation did depend on other properties, things like age and concentration, it could be that that halo occupation distribution fit to clustering puts galaxies in halos of a slightly wrong mass too. And so it could be a combination of those.
I think there's one other thing, right? It could also be that sigma 8 is just lower than what, when they wrote that paper, I think they assumed Planck sigma 8, if I remember. But if you make the sigma 8 similar to what other weak Lensing surveys have found on larger scales, for example, the recent kids measurements, then much of the problem also goes away. So part of it could just be cosmology has a lower sigma 8.
Right. And in fact, this was explored in this paper, Johannes Langer. They did modify sigma 8 and omega matter and see how much it improved things. And so on large scales, at large separation where things are more linear, there's not as much of a discrepancy, but it's a good point that the dependence of the signal on sigma 8 is different on large scale and on small scales. And so part of the tension can be explained by sigma 8. I think they found that they couldn't explain it away completely by just varying sigma 8. But my impression for this tension is that a lot of it is a combination of issues. So sigma 8 might be part of it. Great. Yeah, thanks for the questions. So all these were basically motivations to measure directly the gas profiles from these halos, for example, the CMAS halos. And this is a place where the CMB can help. So here I'm showing from this ACT paper a few years ago now. This is a map of the CMB sky as measured by Planck. And if you crank up the resolution and the sensitivity, to something like an ACT map of back in 2016 already, what you can see is that by eye, some dots pop up. So these point sources that you see in red in emission are active galactic nuclei and dusty star-forming galaxies. But you can also see blue spots. The purple circle is not in the map. It was added to catch your eye. So those blue dots are temperature decrements from thermal Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect. And I'll say a bit more about this. And those blue dots basically are imaging the gas profiles around these halos. And so this gives you an idea of the kind of resolution that an ACT map has about arc minutes. And that starts to be enough to resolve some of those gas profiles. So I talked a bit about kinematic and thermal Sunyaev-Zeldovich effects already. Let me just explain what they are. So these are both effects are a change in the energy of CMB photons as they bounce off free electrons in the gas around halos. And the reason they change energy when they bounce off the gas is because those electrons in the gas are moving. And so when the photon bounces off a moving electron, it's like bouncing off a moving mirror, you get a Doppler shift. Now what causes the motion of these electrons, the two sources, the whole halo has a bulk velocity. And this is then called the kinematic Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect. And as a Doppler effect, it depends on the bulk velocity of that gas, and it depends on the optical depth of that gas. And so this optical depth basically just says how good of a mirror your gas, your cluster is, and it really just counts the number of free electrons. So the kinematic Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect depends linearly on the number density of electron, and so linearly on the gas density, linearly on the baryon density. So this quantity tau and this linear scale dependence with the, this linear dependence with the gas density is the crucial property if you know the bulk velocity. Now, another reason the electrons are moving in this gas is because the gas is hot. And so there's a thermal motion of the electrons. And that's the thermal Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect. It has a known frequency dependence. It also depends on how much how many electrons you have, and so how much gas or how much baryons. And because the electron thermal velocity is isotropic, the linear term cancels, and you're left only with the quadratic term V thermal squared. So this frequency dependence is known, and what you get is a signal proportional to the number density of electrons times the temperature of electrons. And so number density times temperature is basically pressure or thermal energy of that gas. So if you can measure the KSE and the TSE, you're measuring both the gas density and the gas thermal energy and pressure. And so that's interesting because if you have both, you can get a temperature profile, and so you can get at thermodynamic properties of the gas, which are really important in galaxy formation models. I should also point out that if you compare the frequency dependence as a function of frequency of the CMB fluctuations versus the kinematic SE in blue and the thermal SE in green, the kinematic SE has the same exact frequency dependence as the CMB fluctuations. And so you cannot detect it by using multiple frequency maps. On the other hand, the TSE has a specific and well-known frequency dependence. And so you can extract it doing linear combination of frequency maps. Okay, so this was my quick intro to kinematic and thermal SE. Now, of course, I know that there's a lot of experts on these topics in the audience. So I just wanted to point out that there's a lot more applications to thermal and kinematic SE than looking at the baryon profiles around halos. So in particular, one application, since your signal depends on the bulk velocity of the halos, is to focus on the scale dependence of this as a cosmological probe. And there were a couple of really interesting papers from the Perimeter group that showed how to do basically just this, clarified the correspondence between a number of estimators, and showed that you can use velocity information and density information to cancel cosmic variance and learn about non-gas entities on large scales. There was also this interesting paper on how to use fast radio bursts, on which there's also a lot of expertise at Perimeter, in order to remove the tau dependence, this gas dependence of the KSE, and be left with a probe of the velocities. And finally, once you're able to measure the velocity dependence on large scales, there's a lot of things you can learn about. There can be modifications to gravity, neutrino masses, as well as ultra large scales and anomalies. So that's one very important application of KSZ for cosmology, getting at the large scale velocities. Another one is to get at reionization. Part of the kinematic KSZ effect is sourced from reionization, but distinguishing the signal from the KSZ, not from reionization, but from galaxies at late time is difficult. And these papers give a way to do this. And finally, there's other SZ-like imprints that are not just the thermal or the kinematic SZ, and that can have very important consequences for cosmology. And so I just wanted to point this out. So going back to these particular projects of getting at the baryon profiles, what we did is a stacking measurement into our CMB maps of a certain galaxy sample. And so this is the galaxy sample we used. It's called CMAS for constant mass. It's part of the bus survey. And the reason we chose it is the following. It's a large sample of galaxies, and that's helpful for us because our signal to noise is proportional to squared number of objects because that's how we beat down the noise. And it's a massive sample of galaxies. So those galaxies actually trace the center of galaxy groups of about 10 to the 13 solar mass. And our signal to noise for KSZ, since it scales as the gas, the amount of gas, it basically scales as mass. And so we have a sample with many objects and somewhat massive objects. Now this is not as massive as you might expect from say a galaxy cluster, where the mass could be as much as 10 to the 14, 10 to the 15 solar mass. But one reason those galaxy groups with slightly lower mass are interesting is because in these low mass halos where the gravitational potential is not so strong, the effect of feedback is more important because it is easier to push the gas out. So in a sense, the gas profiles in these halos are the ones that have one of the largest response to feedback. Those galaxies also have individual spectroscopic redshifts. This is important, as I'll say in the next slide. It's not technically required, but it helps a lot with the modeling, and it basically buys you a factor of two in signal to noise. As we've said before, there is some knowledge of the halo occupation distribution, which is useful for modeling the signal, with the caveats, as we've seen, that those halo occupation distribution don't fit the lensing well. There is also obviously galaxy-galaxy lensing measurements. I've shown them before. And so we know the mass profile or the gravitational potential of these halos. And finally, methods like BEO reconstruction have been performed on these galaxies. And I don't need to explain in detail what that is, but the key point is that it gives us individual velocity estimates. And let me just illustrate how this works here. So what I have here is a visualization of this galaxy sample, and soon a visualization of individual velocity estimates based on the velocity reconstruction method of Kendrick Smith and Mariana Vargas Magaña and Shirley Ho. And so what you can see, you are here, the observer, because we have redshifts for each of these galaxies, we know how far they are, and so we know their positions in 3D. So you can put those galaxies in a 3D box, and in 3D. And when you do this, you can infer the matter density field from the galaxy number density. And a method like BEO reconstruction or Kendrick's algorithm, or basically the Zeldovich approximation, tells you how to infer the velocity field from the density field by simply effectively saying that if I have more galaxies here, it's because they've been moving in that direction. And so Kendrick basically did this on this galaxy sample. And what you get when you do this are the colorful blue and red points that you see. So each galaxy has been color-coded by its line of sight velocity based on this reconstruction method. And so with this, we now have individual estimates of the velocities. That's particularly helpful for the KSZ stacking, as I'll show in a moment. Again, feel free to interrupt if there's any question. So this is the galaxy sample we used. These are the temperature maps we used. They're described in these papers. And what I'm showing here is simply the footprint. And so lighter green or lighter yellow are deeper patches of the map. And this is the overlap with the bus sample. So the bus galaxies are now shown in red. So those two samples overlap a lot, which is useful. And this allows us to do this stacking measurement. This is what we did. Again, the observer is here. Each galaxy here is color-coded by its line of sight velocity, blue or red, depending on whether it's moving towards you or away from you. And what we did is basically two stacking measurements. One, we stacked the CMB maps at the position of each of those galaxies. And this lets us measure the thermal LZ effect. And another stacking we had to perform, because if you want to extract the kinematic LZ effect, since about half of these galaxies are moving away or towards you, the signal on average is zero. So if you just do a naive stacking, you'll get no signal out. And so instead, what we did is stacked weighted by those individual galaxy velocity estimates. And when you do this, now the velocities no longer cancel, and you can extract the KSZ.
Do you know what the signal to noise on the velocities is? Like you already noticed.
Right. Yeah, so in this particular analysis, the key quantity that we care about is the correlation coefficient per galaxy between the true velocity and the reconstructed velocity. Mm-hmm. That quantity is 0.7, so about 70% is the correlation coefficient between the true and the reconstructed velocities. And this matters in two ways. One, you have to know that value of 0.7 if you want to make sure your measurement of KZ is unbiased. So if you assume a wrong value for this, you will bias your measurement. And two, even if you assume the correct value, your signal to noise is lowered by this value. So basically the signal to noise on our KZ measurement is 70% of what it would be if the velocities were perfect.
But how do you know that maybe I'm missing something. So how do you know what the truth is? Like to say 70%?
Yes. So for this method, this algorithm by Kendrick, and for the other velocity estimates we have from Mariana, they were run on mocks for which so mock n-body simulations and mock sample with CMAS galaxies populated in those halos. And so in those mocks, you know what the true velocity is, and you can compare the answer.
Uh-huh. But then if you're putting the HOD incorrectly, then...
That's right.
Okay, I see.
Right, so there is some dependence on the HOD, but the dependence is not as large as you might think. And one reason is if you look at the size of these blobs of coherent velocities, they are of order 100 megaparsec wide. And so basically what this says is, you know, the correlation length of that velocity field is much larger than the correlation length of the density field. And so if you don't put the galaxies exactly at the right spot, it doesn't matter too much. That's one thing. And the other thing, which is a bit the same statement, is the fact that the velocity field is actually very well described by linear theory. If you look at the RMS velocity per galaxy, linear theory does a very good job. That's related to the fact that most of it comes from very large scales.
And so fingers of God are not important for this sample?
They're not as important, yeah. So in this velocity reconstruction measurement, both Kendrick's algorithm and Mariana's do account for the Kaiser effect, but not the fingers of God. But so this blob, for example, in a transverse direction would be about 50 to 100 megaparsec. And so that does make the fingers of God less important.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks.
A weird question. So since you're stacking on the same galaxies that you're using for the velocity reconstruction, this 70% is purely coming from the shot noise. Is that right?
I would think it's partly shot noise in the galaxy distribution. And maybe part of it, part of the leftover, is nonlinear small-scale velocities and redshift space distortions. Basically, the mocks on which this was compared had Kaiser effect and fingers of God and nonlinear velocities. Whereas the reconstruction method assumes linear velocities and only Kaiser effect. So, right, so the remaining 30%, I'm not exactly sure if it comes mostly from shot noise of galaxies or from nonlinear corrections in the velocity and fingers of God.
Yeah.
Right, and of course, better velocities help because, as I've said, our slope noise here is 70% of what it could be with perfect velocities. And as the signal to noise on these measurements increases, having a good control of the velocity systematics becomes more and more important. Let me now just show you the result of the stacking analysis. And I'll first show some sort of illustration images that show a lot of the properties of those stacks and then give some more quantitative results. So this is the result of this KSZ stacking on CMAS galaxies, so weighted by the line of sight velocities, at the two frequencies that we have, and the inner white, which you might be able to apologize, is the image of those maps, and the outer circle, which is the same in both cases, is the view radius of the halo. Is a little light blob at the centers, and that's basically our KSZ signal.
Sorry, Emmanuel, I couldn't see
a large gradient.
Hear you for a bit. What is the difference between left and right?
I'm sorry. Right. So left is 150 gigahertz, and right is 90 gigahertz. And so what you see is those two maps have a lot in common. So this large scale gradient that you see is in common. And that's because this large scale noise in our stack actually comes from the CMB. And the CMB is the same at 150 and 90 gigahertz. So that's why you see the same large scale gradient. So large scale CMBs are our main noise. And on small scales, you might see a lot of specs. And those specs are different in the two maps because they're mostly coming from detector noise. And that detector noise is independent in those two maps. So I don't know how impressive those images look to you, but it turns out this is the high significance KSZ measurement to date. And so the no KSZ hypothesis is rejected at between 6 and 8 sigma. This measurement is actually a bit more interesting than just confirming that there is KSZ at 6 to 8 sigma. And I'm going to...
Before you go on, just if I can ask another question. So if we look at the F-150 maps, there's clearly a peak at 0, 0, but there's also seems to be some blobs up at the top right, which also look similar. So would that seems in conflict with the 6 to 8 sigma claim.
Right. So the reason that is so these images, and I'll show a more convincing quantitative measurement. These images are more for illustration purpose. And the reason for this is because when you look at this, you are basically spreading 6 to 8 sigma over 1,000 pixels. So if you divide 6 to 8 by 1,000, you get a small number. And the other thing is when we actually detect the KSZ signal, since we're motivated in assuming that the signal is isotropic around the halo, we actually can put down circular apertures. And if you put circular apertures around this point, this little dot here contributes basically nothing around. And so the significance of this is not as large as you might think from this cutout. So maybe this next slide will help explain this a bit better. So what we did in order to get rid of the large-scale CMB noise, because the CMB, as you can see, is mostly uniform or just a gradient across our map on these scales, we use those aperture photometry filters where you take the mean signal in a disk around the halo and you subtract the mean signal in a ring with the same area. So any signal that's constant, that's uniform, like basically the CMB drops down. And so this lets you remove a lot of the CMB noise in the measurement.
So in your previous stack, Manu, why is there like a net gradient once you stack over all the, like, you know, all these random locations that have random gradients?
Right. So basically what happens is the RMS CMB fluctuations in our maps are about 100 microkelvin. And what you can see here is that this map is riding on top of an 8 to 9 microkelvin fluctuation. And so the initial CMB gradient has been averaged down by a lot already. So the CMB fluctuations have been averaged down by a factor of 10, and so has the gradient. So this leftover gradient is much less than a typical gradient on a typical patch of the map with that size. So this is just residual gradient. Now this CMB has been averaged down by a factor of about 10. And I actually should have mentioned this, but our galaxy sample has hundreds of thousands of objects. So if you take the square root of this, you might think you should average down the CMB by more than this. But what happens is that our galaxies are actually really dense. And so many galaxies are in the same hot or cold CMB spots. So the averaging down of the CMB is not by root number of galaxies, but by root number of hot and cold spots. And that's a much smaller number. So you do expect this leftover gradient, and it is much smaller than on a typical patch of the map due to this averaging. And so we perform this stack in those compensated aperture photometry filters, compensated because same area in the disk and the negative ring to cancel the CMB noise. And when you vary this radius, you can think of this as effectively like a cumulative profile. So as you increase the ring, you encompass more and more of the gas, and your signal should go up. And so those data points basically show this is a function of the radius around the cluster. You encompass more and more of the gas. And right, these are the error bars you get. And if you ask how significantly is the no KZ hypothesis rejected on this plot, the answer is 6 to 8 sigma. But more interesting than this, you can actually compare what would you expect to see in KSZ if the gas followed the dark matter. And this is what you see those dashed lines. And so those dashed lines are not fit to the data. They're predictions based on the Lensing mass measurements for these halos, the galaxy-galaxy Lensing measurements. And those are also consistent with the mass estimates based on the spectrum of those galaxies. So using the spectrum of galaxies, converting that to stellar mass, and estimating the halo mass from this. And what you can see is that the dark matter profile is much more concentrated. The way you see this, if you think of this as a cumulative profile, is that it rises up and saturates much faster. And so the dark matter profile is basically all included within, say, those 2 arc minutes, which is not the case of the gas profile. So this shows that the gas does not follow the dark matter.
So another question, if I can interrupt. So is that dark matter profile just the one halo term, or is it the full correlated profile?
Right, so that's a good question. So this profile is only the one halo term. It's not an overall NFW profile. It's an NFW profile for each object at its own redshift and mass estimate and the average of this. So it's realistic in that sense. But as you say, it doesn't include the two halo term. Now, so the clustered mass outside of the halo. Now, if we did include that two halo term, what would happen is that dark matter profile curve would actually keep going up. And so it would, in fact, be even more inconsistent with our data. So even without including that two halo term, the fact that the gas follows the dark matter is rejected. This hypothesis is rejected as at actually more than 90 sigma formally. And so you might wonder, how is it possible that with a 6 or 8 sigma measurement, you reject the dark matter at 90 sigma? And basically, the answer is that those data points within their error bars are much closer to zero than they are to the dark matter profile. So
this 90 sigma, this is assuming that 0.7 cross correlation you said for the velocities.
Right.
So if that was radius dependent in a way that was, such that the signal to noise got worse and worse towards small radii due to things like fingers of God. Would that account for some of this?
So I don't think so, because so this scale dependence here that I'm showing, but that's a very good question. But the scale dependence I'm showing here is not the scale dependence of the velocity correlation function in a sense. It's the size of this aperture, so it's more the profile gas dependence. And on these scales, a few arc minutes, you are at about one or so megaparsec. The velocity field is really, really, really uniform on these scales. The typical coherent length of the velocity field is about 100 megaparsec. I would think, you know, if you got the velocities wrong because of fingers of God, you would get it wrong basically uniformly on this range, because you would have reconstructed the velocities based on the galaxy position and its finger of God. So you would get that velocity wrong. But you would be equally wrong over the profile of this halo. I don't know if that makes sense.
You're saying that the fingers of God don't depend very strongly, you know, they don't depend very strongly on the transverse projected radius. Is that what you're saying?
Or maybe what I'm saying is the true velocity doesn't depend on the projected radius. So the true velocity for that true galaxy group is uniform. Now, I only have one galaxy per group, which is the CMAS galaxy, and I try to attribute a velocity to it. And I may be wrong because of finger of God. So I'm going to attribute to the whole group the velocity of that galaxy, which is off by finger of God. But I think I'll be equally wrong over the whole profile of the galaxy group.
Okay, I think I see.
Right, I think that makes sense, but we can talk about it more later soon.
So can I ask something about this? So for the dark matter, you said you get a constant prediction. So, but since this is compensated, this means that you really have some sort of power law for dark matter, which is
right.
Looks constant here.
Right. So for the dark matter profile, for each galaxy, we assumed an NFW profile. Mm-hmm. And in the NFW profile, there's always ambiguity in what's the truncation radius, where do you stop it? And if you don't mm-hmm. stop it, you have infinite mass. And here we stopped it at one vero radius, which mm-hmm. once convolved with the beam correspond to those vertical lines. Now, if we didn't truncate the NFW profile at one vero radius, but say at four vero radius, that profile would actually keep basically, there's ways to wiggle with this curve, but you can't really make this discrepancy go away. And so, for example, if you said I think my connection is not great. But if you said my estimate for the halo mass was just off, and that's why this curve is too high. So if I wanted to lower the mass to get this to fit those data points, mm-hmm. I would need about a factor of 10 in mass. And this is really, really ruled out by the lensing measurements. Mm-hmm. There's a bunch of ways to play with this curve, increasing the truncation radius, including the two-halo term. But those all seem to make things slightly worse.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
Cool, thank you. So this measurement is already a bit more interesting than a 6 to 8 sigma measurement. It tells you that the gas doesn't follow the dark matter. Because it measures the gas profile in those halos, we can actually answer the question of what was the baryonic contribution to that low lensing tension. And so this is a calculation that Stefania Amodeo and Nick Battaglia did in their interpretation paper. And this plot is effectively the same as I showed before and slightly different units. But this is basically this lensing signal as a function of radius. Dots are the measurements. And the solid red line here is the theory curve if the gas follow the dark matter. And so again, you see that 20 to 30% discrepancy in the fact that the measured lensing is too low. Now, if you're willing to mess with the baryons, probably the most you could do is remove all of the baryons. So if you removed 15% of all the mass in the universe, what you would get is this red dashed line. And so in a sense, this red dashed line is the maximum that one can do with baryons to alleviate this tension. Now, I should say you can, in practice, do a little bit better because if you push the baryons out, presumably you're going to affect also a bit the dark matter profile and make it more puffy. But you won't be able to do much better than this dashed line. Mm-hmm. And now, if instead of removing all the baryons, you place them based on the gas profile we have just measured for these galaxies. And let me reiterate, these are the same exact galaxies. What you get is this blue curve. Right, so this blue curve shows what the Lensing prediction is if you keep the same HOD, but you place the baryons based on their real profile. So you can see that you alleviate part of the tension.
So
but to me, the key here, the key here is basically we have answered this question with data of how much of this tension is due to the baryons. Yes, please.
If you're pushing the baryons, shouldn't there be a bump, a positive bump on large scales? You see what I mean? Push them out with feedback. So shouldn't that give you a little positive blip in this diagram on, you know, as you remove them from the interior to the exterior?
Right. So in practice, this is what people tend to see. So this is the small scale matter power spectrum. And what people find is that on the scales that are basically the ones measured here for Lensing, the gas being pushed out leads to a suppression in power. But as you say, at the, that's not the only effect. So you make the profile more puffed out, you lower the power on these scales. On very, very small scales, something else happens, which is that some of the gas collapses, cools and collapses into stars. And that leads to an increase in power on very small scales. But these are very, very small scales, like K of 10 in the first megaparsec. So for the purpose of those galaxy Lensing measurements, all you see is a lowering of the power.
But I don't think that's the point that Mike was making. I think the point is that if you just push the mass out, there should be excess mass outside the viral radius.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to say. Not so much about the power, which I guess is more complicated, right? Saying something about the smoothness. But just in terms
of related, aren't they?
Mass conservation. They're related, right?
I mean, right. So in his cross power spectrum, you know, then at some low K, I guess the baryon cross power spectrum you're saying should be higher than the dark matter only cross power spectrum, right? At some low K, you're saying.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, it's going to be hard to see it in power spec because it's, I mean, you mix everything like different R's together, but mass conservation is exact in real coordinates. Mm-hmm. So if you push out the gas, there should be more mass outside and less mass inside. And but I guess do you think that's the solution? I mean, it looks like that doesn't solve the problem. So it's probably.
Yes. So I agree with you, of course, in principle that mass is conserved, and if you've pushed it out, there's more mass outside than you would expect. Mm-hmm. I know that this is mathematically included in this effect, in this curve here. And this delta mm-hmm. sigma here, you know, is what galaxy Lensing measures, which is mean surface density in that disk minus surface density in that ring. And so I don't know exactly how it projects onto that quantity.
That's a good point. If you could put that excess mass in a uniform screen, then it would disappear from this diagram. Mm-hmm.
Something like this, yeah. Okay. I think of course your effect is real, that if you push the gas out, there's more. And I believe it's included correctly in this curve. Intuitively, I'm not sure how it works out, that cancellation between the two.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So this for me is a good selling point of this KSE measurement is the fact that you're able to answer the question. How much are baryons contributing to this tension? This much. They don't solve it all, but at least we can check it off the list and use this correction. And something I should emphasize is that computing this correction to galaxy Lensing takes basically no or very little modeling on our part because we are stacking on the same exact galaxies So they have the same distribution of redshifts, of mass. They have the same exact HOD. And they have the same, for example, miscentering between galaxy and the profile. So so this prediction does not rely on complex modeling of the HOD of these galaxies. So that was the KSZ measurement. I'll switch to showing the thermal SZ measurement and what we can do when we have both. These are similar stacked images as I've shown before. So again, CMAS galaxies at 150 gigahertz.
Before you go on, sorry, can I ask you a question? So you mentioned this issue that if you have feedback and you push the gas out, then that would push some dark matter out as well. So did you guys, is that modeled, or I don't think any of these curves have that model?
Yeah, so we didn't include this effect in those curves indeed. And what this effect does is this red dashed line could go down a bit, and our model could also go down a bit. Now, I don't know exactly by how much, but my guess is that this would be a small effect. And when I say I don't know, there are actually simulation measurements of this effect. So there are somewhat, there are prescriptions for how this feedback works. Mm-hmm. So this is something we're interested in looking at further.
Yeah, I mean, since you do measure the gas profile, you can probably say how much feedback you need to get this gas profile and then how much that affects the total mass profile. So yeah, you could calibrate that with simulations. And so that would be kind of a more realistic comparison, right, than just fixing the dark matter mm-hmm. to non-feedback, right? Mm-hmm.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so that's definitely one of the avenues is if you can constrain the feedback parameters based on this gas profile alone, mm-hmm. the hydrosims with those feedback parameters would have the self-consistent effect on the dark matter. So the fact that the gas pushed out gravitationally also mm-hmm. pulls the dark matter out.
Cool.
Yeah, that's a good point. So here are the stack temperature maps without weighting by velocities to extract the thermal SZ. So at 150 gigahertz, 90 gigahertz, and what we should see this broad temperature decrement, and that's the thermal SZ effect. So that's the gas pressure profile. And you see it at both frequencies. But something else you see at high frequencies here is this bright dot at the center, which is consistent with the beam of our map. And that's dust emission from the galaxies in those galaxy groups. And this dust emission is consistent with our beam, so consistent with being point-like. And so this just shows that the galaxy distribution is much more concentrated than the hot gas distribution. This is what we see. Now, here we're not interested in dust. We care about the thermal SZ.
So how much dust is there in these galaxies? I mean, like it's surprising to have like lots of dust in these CMAS galaxies, isn't it?
Yes, we were indeed surprised by this. And I think part of the answer is based on more massive clusters, studies of more massive clusters, the dust emission doesn't seem to be that important. And this might have to do, and here I'm purely speculating, with ram pressure stripping of the dust in galaxies by the hot gas in more massive clusters. That wouldn't happen here. But basically, if you ask how dust emission scales with halo mass, it seems to not go up with halo mass, be much more shallow. And so we were somewhat surprised to see that amount of dust. On the other hand, what Stefania Amodeo did is perform the same stack on Herschel maps, so higher resolution at higher frequencies, and look at the dust emission there. And everything is basically consistent.
Mm-hmm. The exception to the idea that ellipticals, you know, CMAS type galaxies are dust free are the ones that are having star formation in a cooling flow type situation. Just sitting down at the bottom of a potential well. So I wonder if it could be those. I don't know what the numbers are and whether they line up or not. But many of those have substantial amounts of dust in them.
Hmm. Cool, thank you. So we care, here we cared mostly about the thermal SZ. And so we did two things. One is to model out the dust based on the measurement at higher frequency with Herschel. And the other one is used linear combination maps, so cleaned maps of the thermal And those maps were produced by Matt Material, Colin Hill, your next the collaboration. And they basically linear a combination of the 150 and 90 and 220 maps to null the dust emissions. This is our cleaned S map. And once you have kinematic and thermal SZ data together, so to remind you, the thermal SZ depends on density times temperature, and SZ depends on density. Naively, if you take a ratio, you will get that at temperature. If you do this a bit more rigorously, you get this measurement of the temperature as a function of radius. And so we're excited that we're able to start saying something about the thermodynamics of the gas, not just the gas density. And just to guide the eye in terms of order of magnitude, this is the viral temperature you would expect for these halos. And viral temperature is nothing more like than an order of magnitude, so you don't expect that to match. But this just shows that our order of magnitude is not crazy. And I should say this is somewhat unexplored territory because of those low mass halos that are really hard to observe in any other way. Once you have TSZ and KSZ, another thing you can do is try to fit some models. This is what Stefania did, this model based on this paper that fits sort of self-consistently the gas density and the gas pressure in order to get at quantities like how much non-thermal pressure is there, how much energy was injected in the gas, presumably through feedback. And Stefania also fits for the amplitude of two halo terms. And interestingly, so when you fit jointly thermal and kinematic SZ, in this model, and so there is some model dependence, but it's sort of a proof of concept. You can say something about the fraction of non-thermal pressure, something like 30% of the pressure at the viral radius is non-thermal. And you can say something about the amount of energy that was injected in the gas as a fraction of the stellar mass energy. And these numbers here may not be super intuitive, but they amount to about 25% of the total gas energy. So thermal plus gravitational potential energy, 25% of that total gas energy being from feedback. And again, so this is somewhat unexplored territory due to those low halo masses. And so that's something interesting to measure. Finally, Stefania, Nick, and Emily Moser did a comparison of our KSZ data and TSZ data with a number of hydrodynamical simulation. So the curves show the illustrious TNG simulations and an extrapolation from a Nick Battaglia simulation, an extrapolation to lower masses that are not quite resolved in these simulations. And what you can see is that at close to the center, the gas density profile is reasonably reproduced, but not so well outside. And in terms of thermal SZ, basically, nothing really matches the profile really well. And again, this is probably because a measurement of TSZ signal for such low mass halos were not really available at the time these simulations were run. I see this as somewhat of a good news in the sense that we are learning something, and this will be a useful input for the hydro simulations. And so we're hoping to push more in that direction.
So is it fair to say that we just shouldn't trust any of these simulations because they're just so much off, so should just stop using them?
I think that's maybe a pessimistic point of view. So the simulations, I guess, were built to reproduce some observations, and these were not part of them. So you shouldn't trust them to reproduce gas properties inside galaxy groups. I think for more massive galaxy clusters, for example, they do a good job. It is what you're trying to use them for.
They fit the clusters reasonably well.
That's my understanding. Right. And one reason also those low mass galaxy groups are important is that if you look again at the matter power spectrum and you ask which halos contribute most to this, those 10 to the 13 solar mass halos, just because they're very abundant, are one of the largest contribution. And so getting those right will be really important for cosmology. Mm-hmm. So with this, let me just conclude and say that in these two papers, we've presented a high signal to noise KSE measurement to date, 6 to 8 sigma, but that this measurement actually teaches you more than this. For example, it shows that the gas is more extended than the dark matter at much higher statistical significance. It is sufficiently precise to quantify the Berni contribution to galaxy-galaxy lensing. And once you have KSE and TSE together, you can start saying things about the gas thermodynamics. So things like the temperature of the gas and preliminary things about how much energy was injected through feedback, how much non-thermal pressure, and all these will be useful inputs for hydrodynamic simulations of galaxy formation. Now, we'd like to take this a few steps further and use it not only to fix the Berni contribution to galaxy-galaxy lensing, but to cosmic shear, so the autopower spectrum of lensing, and to CMB lensing. And this is work we're doing with Matt and Colin. And once the signal-to-noise keeps going up, there's a lot more things you can start to do, like splitting the samples based on different properties to learn about how feedback works there. So I'll stop there and take any other questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, great. Thanks very much, Manu.
Thanks.
So we can all applaud virtually, or if you can unmute yourself, you can also applaud. okay, so any more questions for Emmanuel? You know, people can pipe up, or I can try to find the places where I can see the raise.
I can keep asking questions. Sorry.
If you go back to the okay, go ahead, Nayesh.
Okay. Well, thanks. Sorry, Mike. So yeah, if you could go back to actually this, you were constrained on thermal pressure. Right. So I just can I ask you, what are the assumptions that went into this?
Right. So there's a bunch of assumptions. let me see if I can find.
I guess are you assuming hydrostatic equilibrium? I guess that's
yes.
One.
There is some assumption. So in principle, one way you could quantify the non-thermal pressure in a pretty model-independent way would be the following: if you write a viral theorem for the gas, this says that there should be a balance between gravity. So the gravity source by the total matter on the gas should be compensated by thermal pressure plus non-thermal pressure minus potentially a surface pressure term. This one typically comes from inflow of mass that pressurizes the gas. And okay, if you ignore this term, one way you could quantify non-thermal pressure in a model's independent way is that you know the total matter profile from lensing, and you know the gas density profile from KSE. So you know exactly the gravitational energy of the gas in the total potential. So that tells you how much is pulled inwards. And so you know exactly how much total pressure there should be. Now that total pressure is part thermal, part non-thermal. And the thermal part you get directly from TSE. So in principle, this is the way we would go about this. And this is one thing we could do once we actually include lensing in this modeling. So with lensing and KSE, you know how much gravity there is, and so you know how much total pressure there is. With thermal SE, you know the thermal pressure, and so if you take the difference, you get the non-thermal pressure.
So, but this now, is valid only inside the viral radius, and I think the radii you were showing are a lot of them are outside the viral radius. So, are you just looking at radii inside the viral radius? Or?
Are you saying this because of the outer pressure term, or?
Well, no, the whole thing is just the viral equilibrium, so it should be inside the viral radius. But then a lot of your data comes from outside, unless you just exclude that somehow.
Right. So in principle, yeah, this statement assumes a balance between pressure and gas. And you could take away some of that imbalance in info. So I agree with you. In principle, you would need this would be valid anywhere within the viral radius or anywhere where it's virialized. Mm. Now, in the model that we used, so there's this caveat and there's other caveats that the lensing data was not actually used to get at the gas profile. So there's a bit more model dependence here. So I could describe how the model works. Mm. So it's the model from these papers. And the way it works is it basically it first assumes that the gas would follow the dark matter profile. And if it does, you can get at its thermal total energy EI, initial energy. Then it assumes that a fixed fraction of the gas turns into stars. That fixed fraction is about a few percent. And that these stars then inject energy into the gas by this amount, where epsilon is a free parameter. And then what the model assumes is that the final energy of the gas is therefore the initial energy plus how much was injected to feedback, plus the change in potential energy by allowing the gas to redistribute. And this model assumes the gas redistributes into a polytrope. So polytrope gives a relation between the gas density and the total pressure. You inject some energy in the gas, you let it redistribute into a polytrope with the correct final energy and with balance between total pressure and gravity. And then there is an assumption for the radial profile of that non-thermal pressure with a free parameter for the amplitude. So there's a lot of model dependence in this model, and it is somewhat toy modely. And so this is why we think of these constraints more as a proof of concept that there is information on this, rather than necessarily the ground truth for the amount of non-thermal pressure profile and feedback. So in a sense, this is sort of a first step towards doing this. And I think including lensing, galaxy lensing, RCMB lensing, will let us take away quite a bit of that model dependence.
Thank you.
But yes, very good question. Thanks.
Any more questions?
So is the upshot that you showed that feedback could have an effect, it was still low compared to the Planck, but if you lowered sigma 8 and added the feedback that you measured, does it then agree with the data or not?
Yeah, that's a good question. I need to read again this paper by Johannes Langer et al. And yeah, that would be a question. My impression was that it may not be enough baryons plus sigma 8. And that in their paper, they sort of concluded that you may invoke something like a galaxy assembly bias to mess up the HOD. But that's a really good question. I should check this.
I was having a look at it. It's the advantage when you're at home. You know, you can speak with one ear. And I think that the correction that you have there, which, you know, is as much as 20%, at small radii, right? And then it kind of gets smaller as a percentage. It's like a constant shift in R delta sigma, right? So they plot it as a percentage, but I think 20% would be pretty close to what they show for the deficit. So it would be interesting to try to put in an alternative model with a different sigma 8 plus the suppression that you're measuring.
Yes, right. Definitely.
And just see whether it lies better along the curve or not.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And another way to exclude potential galaxy lensing systematics is to look at CMB lensing. And I think Matt has been looking into this, and so hopefully we'll know soon how much of this is due to galaxy lensing systematics.
Yeah, galaxy lensing is relatively insensitive to systematic, in contrast to cosmic shear, which is much harder. Cosmic shear is a tough one, but galaxy lensing, you're averaging over many angles and it wipes out most systematics.
Right, fingers crossed.
Any more questions from Anu? I don't see any further hands raised. Okay, so before we go, so Manu has very kindly agreed to meet with people one-on-one on Zoom, and the Zoom link for the meetings is written at the bottom of the sign-up sheet. Okay, so thanks again, Manu, for a fantastic talk. So thanks.
Cool. Yeah, thanks a lot. And thank you so much for organizing the meeting sheet and for the people who signed up. I'm looking forward to it.
Okay, great. So we can stop recording, and we'll see all you guys, I guess, next week.
Cool. Okay. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.